I won't be here long. Are you in this class? Is that what brings you here?
We're very clearly, preeminently in a situation here where no such case need be made. We all know full well how influential Mr. Putnam has been, and so we can just stipulate that and move on to what we're all waiting for, which is talk. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It is terrific to be back in Palo Alto. I've spent some enjoyable and productive times in this city. I have to brag that my most productive year in this city was the year that I managed the Palo Alto City Little League champions. But it's a very pleasant. I don't very often have a chance to brag about that accomplishment. And it's good to have a chance to talk to you about some work that we've been doing. Actually, we've been working on this topic for a long time, 5 or 6 years, 7 years, 8 years. And the findings have been something that we've been struggling with for most of that time, for reasons you'll see, because the findings are challenging in many ways. I'm going to talk about social capital today, and I don't know whether I should assume that most of you know what I mean by social capital or not, but I'll give you the brief social capital 101 introduction. By social capital, I simply mean social networks and the norms of reciprocity that go along with them. You all know what physical capital is. Physical capital is some physical object like a screwdriver, so we can invest in a screwdriver and repair more bicycles more quickly. About 35 years ago, economists began talking about human capital to refer to training and education. So just as you could invest in training in a physical tool, so too you could invest in training and education. And that would make you more productive than you would be if you lack that. And those of us who are studying social capital are saying, yes, that's all that's right. Tools are helpful. Training is helpful. But there are features of our communities that are like that, or the organizations that we live in, or the communities we live in. If you have the good fortune to live in a community or to work in an organization where people are connected with one another in productive ways, you could get more done than you could if you, the same you with the same physical tools and the same training, didn't have the benefit of those social networks. There are many, many ways social networks are good for people who are in the networks, lots of examples of that. People here have done work on the effects of social networks on, for example, job search. But social networks are also, and this is the part of the work that's been most of interest to me in the past, social networks also have effects on bystanders, not just the people who are in the networks, but bystanders. Lots of examples of that that will be familiar to many of you. One of the ways in which social networks is valuable is that I'm particularly conscious of at this very moment, actually, is that people like Rob Sampson and others have taught us that the best predictor of a low crime rate in a neighborhood are how many neighbors know one another's first name. And my wife and I have the good fortune to live in a neighborhood in Cambridge, Massachusetts that has a whole lot of social capital. People in our neighborhood are all the time having picnics and barbecues and sledding parties and so on. Do you know what I mean by a sledding party? I didn't know. So I'm able to be here right now, confident that at this very moment, it's 8:15 in our neighborhood. My home is being protected right now by all of that social capital. Even though, and this is the moment for confession, I actually never go to any of the picnics and barbecues and sledding parties. I'm not proud of that fact. I'm on the road a lot and so on. But I'm able to benefit from the network even though I'm not in the network. And what I've just finished saying is that networks have externalities. They have effects on people who are not just in them. And that is one reason why it's important to pay attention to networks, why it's worth calling them social capital. Obviously, there are a lot of other, if this were a talk in social theory, I'd spend a lot more time talking about the details of social capital. There are different kinds of social networks that are important to pay attention to different kinds of networks. They're not all useful for the same thing. Some kinds of networks have effects in one domain, and other networks have effects in other domains. They're not always used for good things. Social capital can be used for bad purposes, just like a screwdriver can be used for, you can use a screwdriver as a weapon. It isn't usually that, but it you can use it for a weapon, and similarly, you can use social networks as weapons. My favorite example of that actually comes from a former student of mine who, writing in the New York Times, a book review section, actually not about anything of mine, but somebody else's book. This is a student who was writing a review of somebody else's book, and observed the fact, I take it is a fact, that Tim McVeigh had cooked up the Oklahoma City bombing in a bowling alley in Oklahoma City. And the last line of this review is, we all would have been better off if Tim McVeigh had gone bowling alone. Even though I was the target of that jibe, it's a brilliant jibe because it captures the fact not all social capital is used for positive purposes. That's what I've been doing for the last 15 years with the help of people in this room who've been helping to give me remedial work in sociology, looking at social networks. And I now want to ask an important question for our country, indeed for most advanced industrial countries, over the next half century. What is the effect on social capital of immigration and increasing ethnic diversity? The most important, this is what I'm going to argue in this talk. The most certain prediction you can make about any modern society, about the U.S. or about Finland or about Australia or about Japan, is that it will be more diverse ethnically than it is now. All modern societies are going to be more diverse, partly because of immigration, but even if immigration stopped right now, still all societies 25 years from now, all modern societies would be ethnically much more diverse. And basically that's going to be a good thing. Diversity has lots of, is an important social asset in many respects. But I want to report to you some findings, and I'm going to spend most of my time talking about this this third point because it's the one that's, I think, the newest and most troubling. Some evidence that in the short run, at least, diversity is linked to low social capital, low social solidarity. And that will pose the question, which I do think is actually a big important question for the future of this country, but also other countries over the next 25 or 30 years, which is how to reconcile democracy and social cohesion in a context of increasing ethnic diversity. So that's where I'm going. This is a graph just to show you the kind of the trends that are happening everywhere. The vertical axis is the fraction of the population that is foreign-born, and you can we're that red square. So the fraction foreign-born in the United States actually reached its all-time low in 1970, because that was the result of that long period in which immigration to the United States was cut off. But immigration, we liberalized our immigration laws there, and we've had this growing fraction of the U.S. that's foreign-born, but it's true for all these countries. And basically, that's a great thing, because there are many, many advantages to a society of being an immigrant society. America would certainly not be nearly as successful a society as we are if we had not had not just a lot of immigration, but a lot of diverse immigration from very different backgrounds. And this chart basically summarizes a lot of different studies on the creativity, on the importance of the benefits of diversity. There are people in the room who've done a lot more work on this topic than I have. Scott Page here has done important work on the importance of diversity as a predictor of creativity. And so basically I want to stop here and let you talk for an hour to explain the advantages of diversity. A disproportionate number of American Nobel laureates are immigrants, a disproportionate number. If you pick almost any mark of being an outstanding person in America, like winning Kennedy Center Arts Awards or whatever, a disproportionate number of immigrants are in those creative categories. Although there's a lot of debate about it, the net bottom line is that immigration is good for economic advance, although not obviously for every individual native-born person. Is not all of them, all of us are advantaged by immigration, but there certainly is a net advantage. And that's also true for fiscal. There's a lot of talk nowadays about how immigrants are a drain. And there is something to that if your view is only at the local level, because immigrants do tend to be disproportionately large users of education because they're younger and they've got kids, and of hospitals, which tend to be funded at the local level. But on the other hand, they're way net contributors to Social Security. So for people my age, it's really important that we have lots of immigrants to be paying for my cushy retirement. And that's actually true for almost all baby boomers. Baby boomers are going to have a less cushy retirement if we don't have lots of immigrants to help keep the economy moving forward. And you may know, or you may not know, if this is not your field, but there's really some very interesting new research done at the World Bank and elsewhere on the importance of immigration as a development strategy for the third world. Increasing net immigration from the south of the world to the north of the world by some modest amount, 3% or something like that a year, would do more for third world economic development than the most generous trade and aid and debt relief programs you can imagine. So there are lots of big, important advantages from immigration and diversity, both to the receiving country and to the sending country, and for the most part to the immigrants themselves. But what are the social effects of diversity? Now, I'm, for the moment, going to keep flipping back and forth between talking about immigration and talking about diversity, although I recognize that that's an oversimplification because they're not the same thing. Immigration and diversity are not the same thing. It happens that in round numbers, about half of all the ethnic diversity in America is associated with recent immigrants, and about another half of it is basically black-white ethnic diversity. And in principle, you'd want to keep those two things separate. I will ask you just not to worry about that for a moment, because it turns out that actually, for my purposes, it turns out not to be crucial to the story I want to tell. So I'm now going to talk about what are the effects, what would we expect to be the effects of that diversity on social solidarity. Now, as you know, there's a, as you probably know, there are two broad theories about this, and they both have, both these theories have lots of evidence and lots of advocates. One is so-called contact theory. That's basically the idea that if you put people who are diverse together, they'll eventually get to see that we're all brothers under the skin, or we're all sisters under the skin. That is, that you know, you get to know people of a different flavor, and it turns out they're fine, and you like them. That's the contact theory, and I'm going to show you a kind of evidence that's led people to believe that. On the other hand, the other theory also has lots of advocates in different parts of the social scientists who say that actually bringing two different groups together or multiple groups together causes more conflict among those ethnic groups, conflict over scarce resources. And I think actually I think our findings are going to show that neither of those is quite right. But let me just pause for a second to show you the kind of evidence that has led some people to think that this is the evidence, and this is the kind of evidence that supports the contact theory. This comes from something called the American Soldier, which was a great landmark study sociological study during World War II. And one of the questions was white soldiers, how do you feel about having racially mixed divisions, or platoons in this case? And there was a lot of opposition. Remember, this is the 1940s, a lot of opposition to racial mixing if the people had no contact, if the white respondents had no contact with black troops. But the more contact the whites had with black troops, the more they actually thought it would be fine to have racial integration. And that's the kind of evidence that has led over the decades many people to believe in the so-called contact theory. And something like that lay behind the Brown versus Board of Education decision in arguing in favor of racial integration in schools. So there's a lot of evidence on that side. On the other hand, there's a lot of evidence also that social solidarity and diversity appear to be negatively correlated. And recently, there's been a veritable flood of work in this direction. Across localities in the United States, the more ethnically diverse a city is, the lower the social trust, or the lower the social solidarity. Across work groups in the United States and Europe, more diverse working groups tend to be more creative, but they also tend to have lower morale, and people tend to want to leave them more, and people tend, on average, I'm summarizing here hundreds of studies, tend to be less socially cohesive. Across European countries, the more ethnically diverse, if you're having to sit in uncomfortable places, there are plenty of comfortable seats over here. Do you want to come across? I apologize for not noticing that you were being forced to sit on the steps. And probably the fire marshal will be happier too. Anybody else want to join, move to that side of the room? I'm not going to summarize each of these studies. One of the interesting studies it comes from Peruvian microcredit cooperatives. Do you know what microcredit cooperatives are? Small groups, mostly of women, often in developing societies, which they get together and they sort of share their, they take turns borrowing from a common pool of their savings. By the nature of these microcredit cooperatives, they require a certain degree of trust, because the dominant strategy, if people are not trustworthy, is to take the money when it's your turn, and then never go back. And that default rate is a good measure of the degree of social solidarity in a group. And these are all Peruvian women, but the more ethnically diverse the Peruvian the microcredit cooperative, the higher the default rate. It's also true within experimental game settings and carpooling in the United States, which carpooling may or may not sound to you like an interesting measure of social solidarity, but it also turns out to require a certain degree of trust and reciprocity. The most interesting example of this phenomenon, that is the greater diversity produces lower solidarity, actually comes from a study that's about to be published in a new book on the Union Army, the Northern Army in the U.S. Civil War. you've got to understand that the casualty rate in the Union Army was extremely high. Over the course of the war, the casualty rate approached 50%. So your chances of being killed or maimed if you stuck around were very high. On the other hand, if you deserted, the chances of being caught and punished were essentially zero. This is a game in which there's what's called a dominant strategy. I'm out of here. If I stick around, I'm going to get killed or maimed. If I leave, nothing bad's going to happen. So you'd expect in equilibrium the desertion rate to be 100%. It wasn't. It wasn't that high. It wasn't anywhere near that high because of social capital, basically, because what kept people there were their sense of ties to other people in their platoon. But it turns out that the more diverse the company that you're in, the higher the desertion rate. Now, these are all white guys, so diversity in this case does not mean gender diversity or even ethnic diversity. Well, it could mean ethnic, but it doesn't mean racial diversity. It means diversity in terms of age or in terms of geographic origin or in terms of occupation. The greater the diversity in a company, the greater the desertion rate. So all of these kinds of research tend to suggest that social solidarity and the diversity is inimical to social solidarity. Now, I need to say one more bit of, I'm sorry, this is a long premise, and I'll get to the data in a second, but I do need to make one more distinction between different kinds of social capital. It turns out to be relevant in this context, and it's a distinction that is now, I think, pretty general in the social sciences between ties that link you to other people like yourself, that's generally called bonding social capital, and ties that link you to people who are unlike yourself, which is generally called bridging social capital. So my ties to other elderly white male professors is my bonding social capital, and my ties to people of a different generation or a different gender or a different ethnic background or occupation, that's my bridging social capital. I'm not saying bridging good, bonding bad, because if you get sick, the people who bring you chicken soup are likely to reflect your bonding social capital. I am saying that a society that has only bonding social capital and no bridging social capital looks like Belfast or Bosnia or Beirut, that is, tight communities but divided with a high civil war potential. So a modern diverse society needs lots of both bonding and bridging. Like bodies need vitamin A and vitamin D, you need both a lot of bonding and a lot of bridging. Not one or the other, but both. So far, so good, except that bridging social capital is harder to build than bonding social capital. Your grandmother knew that. Your grandmother told you birds of a feather flock together. What she meant was bridging social capital is harder to build than bonding social capital. She didn't think you'd understand that, which is why she used the avian metaphor. So the challenge in a diverse society is the kind of social capital that's really most important is the kind that's hardest to build. And I want to come back in a second to talking about bonding social capital and bridging social capital. You'll see why that's an important distinction to be made. I want to now present to you some results. Now, the next 20 minutes are going to be kind of hard, so I want you to stick with me and don't make any assumptions about what my interpretation or views actually are until I've gotten to the end of it, because I'm going to present it's going to be hard. It won't be hard intellectually. You're all smart, but it's going to be hard to take. The evidence here in this study is all U.S.-based. We don't know if it's true in other countries. There's some evidence that it might be true in other countries. It's based on a very large sample done in the year 2000, in which we interviewed 30,000 people from all over the country. And we use the definition, in our analysis, we've used the definition of race or ethnicity that is used, is standard in the U.S. Census, that is white, African-American, Asian American and Hispanic. I know there are a lot of problems with that definition, and I know it's a socially constructed definition, and I'm going to come back to that in a second, but from an analytic point of view, it's useful that we use that because that's what the Census Bureau does. And I'm also not going to talk here about a dozen community-based field studies we're doing, which are part of the larger project. Here are the places where we've done this work. We've actually done it right here. Palo Alto was included in the study, so Silicon Valley is there, as well as East Bay and San Francisco, but a lot of other places you've heard of, like Los Angeles and Houston and Baton Rouge and Boston and so on, and some places you haven't heard of, like the Kanawha Valley in West Virginia, which is a tiny little valley in the Appalachian Mountains of West Virginia, and Bismarck, North Dakota, and a town, I mean a county in rural South Dakota, which has a total population. In each of these places we have interview samples of 500 or 1,000. The total population there is only 2,000 in this. So we interviewed about one out of every three or four people in the county. It got to be kind of a status symbol if you'd been called by the Harvard people to be interviewed. So they're very, we got a lot of big places and small places and rich places and poor places and educated places and not so educated places and diverse places and homogeneous places. These places differ a huge amount in their degree of diversity. Los Angeles and San Francisco are arguably the two of the most ethnically diverse habitations in human history. They're very ethnically diverse, and so is New York City, but we didn't happen to have, New York was not in our sample. On the other hand, in rural, this county in rural South Dakota, it's amazingly homogeneous. Diversity Day is celebrated there by inviting a few Norwegians to the Swedish summer picnic. We got some places that are highly diverse and some places that are not so diverse. And the question we want to ask is, let me not get to that picture yet, how does the degree of social capital, social connection, social solidarity vary across as a function of the ethnic diversity of the place? I'm going to begin at the aggregate level of analysis, using as a unit of analysis the place, because it's going to be just easier to explain what I'm doing. But then I'm going to, later on in the talk, switch from using the unit of the community's unit of analysis to using the individual as unit of analysis. But just for the moment, let me show you what the pictures look like using these as a unit of analysis. This horizontal axis is the Herfindahl index of racial homogeneity. It actually turns out not to matter much what index you use, but this is the standard way of saying how diverse a place is. So here's Los Angeles and San Francisco and East Bay and Silicon Valley. And way up there is that place in rural South Dakota, along with Bismarck, North Dakota, and Lewiston, Maine, and some other very homogeneous places. And the vertical axis here is interracial trust. We had asked everybody in the survey, how much do you trust blacks, whites, Asians, and Latinos? And we knew what they were. So this is the average for every person of their level of trust toward the other three racial groups. You understand? So, and this looks like a perfect example of what you might call the conflict theory. That is, the more diverse our community, the lower the level of social trust. That's a really strong relationship, as you can see. It passes what is technically called the interocular trauma test. It hits you between the eyes that there's something going on in that graph. But now, maybe that's what we should have expected, that there's a higher degree of trust in places where people look like you. How about just asking about your neighbors? How much do you trust your own neighbors? And this just asks the question, basically on a scale, how much do you trust your neighbors? Now, because of racial segregation in America, most people's neighbors look more or less like them. So this is no longer asking how much do you trust the people of the other sort, just your own neighbors. And again, but you see absolutely the same pattern, basically. Now, Silicon Valley is kind of interesting because it's a high deviate. That's not a term of abuse. I mean by that, people in Silicon Valley trust their neighbors more than you'd expect, given how diverse the place is. Still less than most people in America. There's a lower level of trust of neighbors here than in most places in America, but compared to how diverse it is, it's pretty remarkably trusting. But again, it's a strong relationship. But now I want to ask and go a little further. How about trusting people who look like you? So now I want to look at what the graph looks like for which we use as the vertical axis of this next graph, whites trusting whites, blacks trusting blacks, and so on. It looks exactly the same. And this graph is completely inconsistent both with the conflict and with the contact theory. Because what this graph says is, the more diverse your neighbors, the less you trust anybody, even people who look like you. And I'm going to, in a second, give you some. I've so far just been using trust. There's a lot of other variables that follow the same pattern. But in order to give you the punchline here, all of the data tends to suggest that the more diverse the area in which you live, the more all of us hunker down, pull in from everybody else, people who look like us and people who don't look like us. I haven't yet proved that to you, but that's where I think I'm going to try to prove to you. The ethnocentric trust, that is, the greater trust of your own type versus trust of other type, is not related to that diversity. That graph is actually looks like it's a random distribution. There's a literally zero correlation between ethnocentric trust. So it's not, and this is important to people sometimes carry away from, hear this talk and they carry away that Putnam says that in areas of greater diversity, there's more, race relations are bad. That's absolutely not what this shows. Race relations aren't bad, any worse on average, in places that have greater diversity. It's not that in greater diversity we sort of choose in we, they, and we love the people who are like us and hate the people who are unlike us. It's that we just don't know what to do. We don't trust anybody. That's the one of the more surprising parts of the study. Okay, I said that I was going to, I'm now, in order to try to minimize the total number of the weight of data here, I'm going to just summarize for you. There are a lot of other things that turn out to be strongly correlated with ethnic diversity. The greater the ethnic diversity of your community or of your census tract, the less confidence you have in local government and local leaders, the less confidence you have in your own political efficacy, the less ready you are to cooperate in solving dilemmas of collective action. I have to pause here to say, one of the questions we ask is, suppose there were a water or power shortage in your community, and the authorities asked people to conserve, how likely is it that your neighbors would conserve? So that was the question we asked. Then it turned out, right after we did the study, there was in fact a water shortage or power shortage, whichever it was, I've forgotten, I think it was power shortage, in California. And it turned out people were good at predicting whether their neighbors would conserve or not. That is, I'm going to appeal to all your biases, people in Northern California basically thought it was more likely than people in Southern California did that their neighbors would conserve if they were asked to, and they were right. People in Northern California did conserve more. So this is a question, it's a fundamental issue of the limit of collective action. People are less likely to volunteer, less likely to give to charity, less likely to work in community projects. We even have fewer friends and confidants. One of the standard questions, actually ask yourself this question. It's one of the questions we use, but it's a standard question for medical sociology. Suppose you had some serious personal problem like cancer or divorce or something. How many people do you know you could talk with about that problem? Think to yourself right now. How many people, if you had some serious personal problem? The average in America is, average answer is about 6. It's on average 3 for guys and 9 for girls. Women, I mean. And it's a strong predictor of your life expectancy. The higher your number in response to that, the longer you will live. Indeed, there are some people who claim that that's a better predictor of your life expectancy than having a medical exam now would be. So it matters a lot. This is a different lecture, but it matters a lot how many close confidants and friends you have. And what the research says is the more diverse the community you live in, the fewer confidants people have. People are less happy. They rate the quality of life in their neighborhood less. They're less likely to vote. But, and now I want to get to the two things of which there's more in more diverse communities are protest marches and TV watching. TV watching is substantially higher in more diverse communities, and there's no difference in organizational involvement, so bowling alone is not affected one way or the other. But the basic image you get from this, what I've summarized so far, I haven't shown you any of the guts yet that would allow you to tell you whether I've actually proved this, but I'm trying to make the argument, and then I'll show you then I'll get to the qualifications in a second. But the basic argument is the more diverse our environment, it appears, the more we kind of hunker down, pull in from everybody, from our friends and neighbors, from strangers, from people who look like us, from people who don't look like us, and we basically hunker and watch TV. Unhappily, we sit unhappily in front of the TV. Now, there's one thing that goes in the opposite direction. This is the bit of good news. When I saw this graph, I thought, oh, this is wonderful. At least there's something that goes up with diversity, because this is how many interracial friendships you have. So as you go from more homogeneous to more diverse places, people have more interracial friendships. That's great. There is a problem about that. There's a pool effect here. If you live in a really homogeneous place, it's hard to have friends. There's only in this town in this county in rural South Dakota, there's only one Asian American in the whole county, and he's booked for lunch for the next 6 years. So what we basically want to know is, it's not just how many interracial friends do you have, but compared to randomly, if you just sort of walk down the street and randomly pick people, how diverse would your friendship be? So we want to sort of standardize. And the next graph I'm going to show you, in effect, standardizes for what you'd get if you just randomly went down the street. And that graph looks like this. And this is, we're back to bad news. That is, people in Los Angeles, it's true they have more diverse friends, but they have substantially less than you'd get if you just randomly walked down the street and made friends. Whereas people in those homogeneous places up there actually have more diverse friendships than they get randomly. It's a little bit, I don't know what's going on in motivational terms, but it would make sense if you describe this as saying people have a kind of a target of how diverse they want their friendship group to be, and if there's not enough diversity in the environment, you actually go out and try to make additional more diverse friends, but the folks down in these communities are trying to hold down below what they would get if they just made friendships randomly. So now is the time to get to all the really tough questions, and I want to invite you to think of all the things that might be wrong with the data that I just showed. First of all, we don't know whether this is a compositional effect. Is it something about the kind of people who are in Los Angeles, or is it living around the people in Los Angeles? That's the first point. Secondly, Los Angeles compared to this rural South Dakota, it differs in a lot of ways, not just diversity. Los Angeles is bigger, it's more mobile, and in general, places of high immigration and diversity almost by definition are more mobile, and we know that mobility has the effect of making us not know our neighbors as well. These diverse communities are less egalitarian, and I want to say just a word about selection bias. It's an important issue. Let's see if I can give a quick introduction to selection bias. Anytime you want to look at the effects of a neighborhood on people who live in that neighborhood, you have to take into account the fact that people choose where they want to live. So if people of a certain sort are concentrated in some neighborhood, it might not be because that neighborhood caused them to be that way, but something about that neighborhood attracted them to be there. So that, for example, it turns out that in census tracts in which there are schools, on average, there are more parents. But that's not because the school caused them to become parents. It's because parents tend to get drawn to that kind of a community. So that's what I mean by selection bias. That is, so maybe anytime you look at any kind of effect of the sort that we're talking about here, that is the effect of the community on you, you've got to worry about, could there be something about the kind of people who get attracted to that community? Now, in this case, there's a lot more to be said about selection bias, but the core idea in this case, remember, in this case, what we're finding is people who live in more diverse communities are basically more paranoid. They're basically more introverted. Now, if you think that's a selection bias, that the selection bias caused that, you have to believe that somehow people who are paranoid and introverted they go out of their way to live in diverse communities. That seems a little implausible. Or to phrase it a different way, the way in which you'd get selection bias, the kind of selection bias that would produce our results would be the following sort. That is that if you've got an all-white community and then you have some non-white people moving into it, the first people to leave are the most tolerant and the most open-minded. And the last people to leave are the least tolerant and least open-minded. That's the only kind of selection bias that would produce our results. That seems completely implausible to me. It seems to me, in fact, that selection bias is likely to be operating the other way around. That is, that our results are probably an underestimate of the total effect of the diversity on these cases. Well, obviously, in order to get at this, yeah, Woody? Hold that for just 1 second, because they do. Can I come back to that in a second? Because I want to say first of all, I'm now going to move, for those of you who are paying attention to the methodology, from using the community as a unit of analysis to using individuals. I'm not going to come back to me, Woody, if I don't get it right. Moving from the community as the unit of analysis to using the individual unit analysis. And so now from now on I'm going to be talking, we're looking at the attitudes or the behavior, television watching or voting or giving to charity or having friends or whatever, of an individual, trying to predict that from a whole array of characteristics of that individual and another array of characteristics of that individual's community. So we're holding constant your education and your neighbor's education, your income and your neighbor's income, your mobility, how long you've lived there, and how long your neighbors have lived there. Because since we know, I didn't say this, but since this study was done simultaneously with the U.S. Census, and we know exactly where all of our respondents live, we are able to link this to census data, and therefore we know exactly not only how long you've lived there, because we asked you that, but we know how long your neighbors have lived there. So for all of these variables, we're simultaneously controlling at the individual and aggregate level. Is that, you understand what I'm, if you don't understand what I'm saying, raise your hand, because what I've just said is actually a lot. There's a ton. We can only do this because we've got a very large sample. We've got 30,000 people. So we can control for many, many, many things, including region. That is one of the things we're doing, controlling for in the background here is region. So if the Sun Belt is more mobile, we get that. That's already controlled in the model, both in the individual's mobility and in the neighborhood's mobility, and in the regional dummies. Is that making sense? There's a lot of controls, in other words, here. It's not an experimental study, so we didn't randomly assign people to neighborhoods to see how they looked, but it's a very, very robust set of findings. And we measure diversity in many different ways and across many different measures of social capital, with all this stuff controlled in the background, for all major ethnic groups, there's a significant, strong, negative effect of diversity on all those measures of social capital. I actually have one of the 4,000 regression tables that we've looked at. It's there. If you want to come back and look at the numbers, I'm happy to do this. But what this shows is that we've controlled for a ton of other things, and there remains across all these different measures of independent variables, every single measure of social capital that I've measured, that I have mentioned, I mean, has survived this kind of robustness testing. Now, there are other things you might ask. Well, you might say, well, okay, so we hunker. Maybe women don't hunker as much as men. Or maybe white people are kind of more afraid of diversity than non-white people. Or maybe, you know, it's old fogies who hunker, but young folks, we've grown up in a different era, and so we're not so likely to hunker. And so we've technically done interactive models. One way to think of it is we've looked separately at each of these groups, different age groups, different racial groups, different gender groups, different class groups, and the short summary is everybody shows the same basic pattern. It's not just white people, it's not just, you know, black people or any other particular category of people, it's not just, women are faintly more likely to hunker than men, but not much more. Rich folks are about as likely to hunker as poor folks, or vice versa. And most surprisingly, and I know that you won't believe this, but it's true, young people in their 20s, are just as likely to hunker as older people in response to the same level of diversity. And by the way, this we can replicate this whole study. God, I want to go quickly because I haven't gotten to the most important point yet. The same thing is true whether we use measure diversity by immigrants or black-white diversity. I'm going to skip this. I'm not going to skip this part because what I want to say here is that I want to make three points and tell a couple of stories. First of all, don't misunderstand this. These results don't show that diversity causes bad race relations. What it shows is diversity causes fractionation and isolation. Secondly, this is not an argument against either diversity or immigration. It's saying there are some challenges that are posed by diversity that we need to worry about, but it's not saying on net we'd be better off if we didn't have diversity. First of all, we're going to have diversity, and secondly, on net we benefit from that. Why do I sound defensive about this? Because I was a poster boy on Pat Buchanan's website when this study was published. Pat Buchanan says Harvard professor shows that we'd be better off if we didn't have all these immigrants around, which is not at all my view. I'm talking about one side effect that we need to think about. But the most important qualification, and this is what I'm going to now talk about for the next maybe 10 minutes here, these racial and ethnic divisions are socially constructed. And things that are socially constructed can be socially reconstructed, deconstructed and reconstructed. I recognize that sounds like jargon, so I want to just tell you about my granddaughter. My daughter is married to a Costa Rican guy, and for a long time they lived in San Jose. They have three kids. And then my daughter got a job at Pitt, so they all moved to Pittsburgh 3 years ago. And my eldest granddaughter, Miriam, went to school. She was in the third grade. And at the end of the first week, she came home and said to her mother, my daughter, "Mommy, what's Hispanic mean?" And because people say I'm Hispanic, but I'm not Hispanic, I'm Costa Rican. What does Hispanic mean? And my daughter, now I got to understand, my daughter is a social historian of race and ethnicity. So, and she's a little postmodern, too. So all of her circuits are a quiver, right? On the other hand, she's a mom, so she's got to figure out, you know, she's got to know, wants to be sensitive and so on. So she says, well, Hispanic is what North Americans say, that's the word they use to describe people whose parents were born in Latin America. Miriam, who's smart, said, "Oh, is Daddy Hispanic?" "Yes." "Are you Hispanic?" "No." Now you know what the next question is, right? "Am I Hispanic?" And my daughter said, "Well, it's a complicated question, Miriam." And then she wrote me, "I'm studying the social construction of ethnicity at my own dinner table." Now what Miriam was coming to grips with is that the way we in North America divide up the world is not kind of God-given or immutable. These lines are, I don't want to say chosen by anybody. It's not like anybody, we had a vote, we said, okay, we're going to divide the world in this fourfold way. But these certainly change over time. These divisions, the way we categorize people, changes a lot over time. I want to tell you maybe one or two more stories illustrate this. I mean, I could, you know, give you the academic stuff, but I just want to tell stories here. My wife and I two of our closest friends live in Lexington, Massachusetts. Roger and Betty Borgazzani. Roger, as you can tell from his last name, is Italian. Betty is Irish. That is, her parents or grandparents came from Ireland. His parents or grandparents came from Italy. When they got married in the 1960s, everybody involved called that a mixed marriage. Now it's a joke, right? I mean, they're both Catholics. How could it be a mixed marriage? One of their kids is married to a Jew, the other is married to a Sikh. So the notion that two Catholics getting married was a mixed marriage is now a joke. It wasn't a joke then. And the joke turns on the fact that in our lifetime, that line between Irish and Italian Catholics has been more or less erased. Not entirely erased, but mostly erased. It's not erased in Betty's mind. Betty still prefers to vacation in Ireland, and Roger still prefers to vacation in Italy. And when he cooks, the nights he cooks, they're more likely to have tomatoes in the mix. So it's not like they don't know, but it isn't a kind of sharp line of cleavage, as it was for their parents. I want to give another example of this. I grew up in a small town in the Midwest in the 1950s. When I was in high school, I knew the religion of every person in my high school. Even now, if you show me the yearbook, I can go through and I can say Catholic, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, Jewish, Episcopalian. I don't remember any of the names anymore. That part of the hard disk is just totally shot. But I can do this. And actually, that's kind of a neat trick. You might say, well, okay. And my kids can't do that at all. My kids cannot do that at all through their high school yearbook. Now, why is that? You might say, well, Putnam's kind of queer. He's got this thing for religion. But actually, everybody in my high school could do that. They all could do that trick, and now almost nobody can do the trick. Why is that? Well, if you think about it very long, the crucial thing you need to know is that religious endogamy, that is marrying people inside your own faith, used to be the rule, was the rule in America in the 1950s, and for the most part, there's some exceptions to this, but for the most part, religious endogamy has vanished in the United States. What that meant was when I was growing up, for the most important thing in any adolescent's life, that is mating, or in those years, dating, you had to know the religion of everybody else because you had to know. There were some girls in my class who were beautiful and smart and vivacious and so on, but they were not plausible dates. And there were some that were. Fewer, but there were some that were. And then there were some guys that were my rivals and other guys who weren't my rivals at all. And so in order to keep track of that, I had to keep track of, people's religion. And not only me, but everybody had to do that. Nowadays, and since we don't use religion as a marker for these mating decisions, why would you bother to keep track of people's religion? I mean, we don't keep track of people's handedness. We don't go around saying, I remember she was right-handed, left-handed, because we don't make any decisions on that basis. It's not that people are no longer religious. People still are very religious in America, actually. Probably almost as religious in many respects as they were when I was growing up. But that line of division has been reduced substantially in terms of any practical decisions we make about other people. Not entirely, but largely. So what I'm really trying to say is that the identity is the key to our dilemma. Identity is socially constructed. And identity and social connections are reciprocally linked. That's the point of the stories this is the jargon for the stories that I've just told you. And adapting to diversity requires the reconstruction of our social identities. Not, this is really important, not making them like us, not changing the identities of the immigrants, but changing what us is, changing the permeability of the boundaries. And one of the great achievements of human civilization is that we are actually able to do that. I mean, it's quite remarkable. Humans are able to redraw these boundaries. That's what's happened in my lifetime, actually, with respect to at least some of these boundaries. And there are some success stories. I've described to you the religious pluralism in America. It's actually a remarkable success story. The U.S. military is another remarkable success story. There's really good research that shows that the average number of interracial friendships is much higher among soldiers or people serving in the military. It's especially the Army, actually. The level of interracial friendships, close interracial friendships, is much higher among military soldiers than equivalent people of the same age and socioeconomic background in civilian life. Now, you might say, well, of course, come on, it's a military. Well, they have to stick out. They have to stick together. But actually, that wasn't true 30 years ago, 40 years ago in the Vietnam War. It wasn't true that race relations was a big success in the American military. There was interracial fragging, that's what it was called, throwing fragmentation bombs in the tents of people of a different race. So this is the important, amazing success story. In the last 40 years, there has been a dramatic change in the degree of a reduction in the degree of hunkering within the U.S. military. That's important, not because I think that the solution for all these immigrant societies like ours is to have martial law. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm saying that I'm trying to illustrate that we do, in real institutions, we do make these changes. One of the things that I'm working on right now is a study of religion in America, and The another major success story in America in terms of racial integration and connection are large evangelical mega churches. I don't know. Can I see your hands if you've ever been in a large event? If you anybody here who's attended an evangelical mega church? Okay, well then I need to tell you about them for the rest. We need to tell the rest of them about, people about them, because we've been visiting in the course of this research. We've been visiting a lot of these large churches. I, for example, not long ago was at Lakewood, which is the largest church in America. Actually, it's a church in Houston. Church is not quite the right word. I went to one of the smaller services, so there are only 5,000 people at the service I was at. It was a Saturday night service. The membership in the church is 30,000. It's held in the former basketball arena in Houston. And here's the image. The experience I want to share with you. I walked in, and this was the largest, most micro-integrated gathering I've ever been in my life. In my pew, well, it's a basketball arena, so it's not like a pew, but in the place that I was sitting, there was a Latino couple sitting here, and then me, and then a blonde, and then a couple that I took to be a Korean couple, Asian American, and then a African American couple. So right in this one row, it was like Central Casting had said, "Let there be diversity." But the whole place was like that. 5,000, Harvard could not produce that. I don't think Stanford could produce an audience that was micro-integrated in which everybody was hugging everybody else. This was a Pentecostal. They did a lot of hugging. There was a lot of dancing, and so I didn't feel completely integrated. And we know, actually, that sounds like I'm just telling a story, which I am, but it's also true, statistically speaking, in our very large survey of religion that we've done, not this survey, but another more recent survey we've done, that evangelical megachurches are way more integrated than other churches, and it's certainly not no longer true in large evangelical megachurches that the most segregated hour in America is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. That's what Martin Luther King is supposed to have said, and it may be true in some parts. It is actually more true in mainline Protestant churches, Methodists and Baptists and so on, not Baptists, Methodists and Lutherans, but it's not true for these evangelical megachurches. So now, why is that? Well, both the military case and the church case, the religion case, I think it's the story is something like this. At least for the period that people are there, some other identity has trumped their racial identity. It's not that people didn't, in that pew with me, it's not that we all knew what race we were. But for that period, at least that we were there, some other identity was more important. In that case, a religious identity. In the military case, a military identity was more important. And I think that the larger issue, if we had more time, I'm conscious of how much time I've taken up, so I want to make sure you have a chance to get back at me now. But I think if we look back at the history of immigration in the United States, we as a country have done this once before. We've been through a period of great massive immigration in which people of different, we then said different races were coming here. Races in that case meant Jews from Russia and Italians and Poles and so on. And we successfully, over 40 years, successfully created a new us. An us in which that process consisted of the following kind of thing. At the beginning of the period, we talked about Jewish humor. But at the end of the period, nobody says, when you watch a Woody Allen film, you don't say, "Oh, isn't that interesting, all that Jewish humor?" It doesn't. We've just no longer cast it in those terms, in those ethnic terms. That's because we have successfully created a new us, not made Woody more like us WASPs, but we've created a new sense of integration. So, immigration. Here's the conclusions. Immigration poses challenges for our societies, and I think it probably doesn't do progressives like me. I don't think our side, and I don't want to impose that political identification on you, but I don't think it does us, those of us who are in favor of diversity, in favor of immigration, in favor of progressive causes, any good to hide from the fact that diversity is not easy. On the other hand, I also think that, and this is why I've been unhappy about the conservatives who over the last 6 months have been lionizing me, I have to say. They basically claim this is immutable. You can't fix this. People of diverse types are like oil and water. We just never mix. And that's demonstrably not true in our own history. And so I think the central issue for progressives in this era, in order to maximize the benefits that we're going to gain from this diversity and to minimize the short-run challenges, the central issue is how to foster a more capacious sense of we. If this were a really political talk, the next paragraph would be about Barack Obama, but I'm not going to do that. Thank you. You've been terrifically thoughtful and patient. Shall I take questions myself?